Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your lost car in a long parking lot of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. Okay, so a couple of caveats at the beginning of this episode. Number one, my old mailbox is being drilled to bits outside of the studio today. So if you catch a little bit of construction work, that is not a commentary on our subjects today or our guests. That is just the endless march of capitalism outside of our window. Number two, last week's episode, you may have suspected, was pre-taped. And I want to be honest about that because I was traveling last week and I thought, surely with me away, like, what are the odds that something so crazy could happen that I would feel we have to do a podcast about? Like, what are the odds? And then, of course, not only did one crazy thing happen, but two crazy things happen. Number one, Beyonce at Coachella. Number two, Kendrick Lamar and the Pulitzer Prize. And here we are on a Monday, an off day for a podcast, but not an off day for John Caramonica, Pedro Rosado, or my two guests who are coming to bring that fire today. Salome Shatila's here. She's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, a regular writer for the Arts and Leisure section here, and very germane for this conversation, teaches a class on Beyonce et al. At UPenn. Hey, Salome.
Hi. I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited to have your first podcast, not just first popcast appearance, but your first podcast appearance.
Yes.
Okay.
Both. Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
Yes. We're excited to have you make your audio debut here. Yay. To your left, my buddy, Doreen Sanfelix.
Hello.
I'm so happy you're here.
Nice to be here again.
Doreen has been with us before. Doreen is a staff writer at The New Yorker and also wrote quite eloquently about both of last week's Hallmark events. So we're going to start with B, and then we're going to get into Kendrick later. And later, we're also going to be joined by Zach Wolf, who's the classical music editor here, to explain to us exactly what the hell a Pulitzer Prize is in music. But first, Beyonce. I know where I was when Beyonce played Coachella. I was crammed in amidst tens of thousands of people in a field in Indio, California, extremely uncomfortably. Where were you guys? Were you guys both on the East Coast?
Yes.
So you were up in real time.
I was up in real time.
And just for clarity, that show started at 11:20 p.m. Pacific time, more or less. So that means 2:20 a.m.
Yes.
And went till 4 a.m.
Yes.
Which are my normal hours. But yes. So it was early for me. But like, I know most folks don't rock like that.
I was aware of something else that was happening in Ohio, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which you wrote about in your piece as well. So I was kind of hyper conscious of the historic nature of the day. And I knew something was going to happen at Coachella, but you just never know what. We're going to talk about this, but you just don't know what's going to happen with Beyonce. So I think we've been waiting for 2 years for this performance, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, because she was originally supposed to perform last year. She got pregnant, and then she bumped it a year.
Yeah.
Now, also Cardi B performed pregnant this year. Let's just also
wonderfully
say.
Wonderfully, she did.
We'll just say that.
I do not keep those hours regularly. Yeah. Usually I wake up at 5:30 or 6. So I actually
You're
stagger.
Living so well.
Listen, I'm trying to, black doesn't crack, but it needs some help. So starting from Wednesday, I actually staggered my sleeping schedule so that when Saturday night came, I wasn't caught out there. You know what I mean? And so I woke up like I had a good 6 hours of sleep. I woke up at 1. Part of the reason why I woke up a little bit earlier was because I wanted to catch the vibe of Coachella as it was being live streamed before Beyonce, because that's part of the experience too.
Have either of you guys ever been to Coachella?
No.
I have not.
We can talk about the dismalness, but please finish. We'll get around to that.
So, you know, I'm sitting there. I'm completely submerged into the darkness that is Post Malone. And a lot of people have bad things to say about him. I don't. I think he actually, I mean, you can't deny the hits. Every single one of those songs is, you know, making a dent in the culture, as they say. But it was like
perhaps exploiting a previously existing dent. I mean, either one.
Bit. Post Malone doesn't think that he's been affected by blackness, but, you know, to each his.
I mean, he's no bad baby. Like, who among us?
She's a social justice warrior.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm here for Danielle. But I ended up being kind of like soothed by him. Like, it was almost like watching like a very macabre lullaby go down. And then to just have Beyonce come in and like completely jar the atmosphere, it made me wonder, what was it like for you being there and seeing people being like, you know, experiencing that whiplash of act to act and genre to genre and all that thing.
The way Coachella is set up, if you guys have not been there before, so it's a huge field. It's on a polo field. And there are, I believe, 7 stages kind of strewn around the outer edge of the field, or maybe one's kind of in the middle somewhere. So Post Malone was playing on one of the far stages. Mm-hmm. So if you were standing kind of in the middle of the field just before Beyonce, you can kind of look one way and feel that kind of like Post Malone molasses. And then you looked at the main stage where Beyonce was eventually going to play and Haim was playing. And Haim, you know, very enthusiastic, emphatic female sister rock trio who I think understood that their job was to finish their set as cleanly as possible and get the hell out of the way so that Beyonce could perform. You just could feel like the last 10 minutes of that set, they were just like, okay, great, Beyonce's coming, bye. And so this was on Saturday night. I'd been at the festival on Friday. The Weeknd was the headliner on Friday. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I noticed on Friday was after whoever had performed before the Weeknd on the main stage, who's escaping me at the moment, the area down front, which I guess is technically a VIP area, it's wherever my pass got me into, basically completely emptied out. And then people kind of like straggled in for the Weeknd. Mm-hmm. So when I was thinking about where do I want to stand, I sort of thought, oh, well, I'll kind of stand at the edge, wait for people to empty out after Haim, and then I'll just like make a break for it and get as close as I can to the stage. People did not move. Mm-hmm. Like, I would say 2/3 of the crowd that was there was basically there just so they can get their position for Beyonce.
Which makes you wonder about some of those like Beehive members like, sitting through Haim.
Just like, like, this is what y'all like? This is what's happening here normally? And there was a full like, in terms of the transition from one performance to the other, if I'm not mistaken, the transition between Haim and Beyonce was longer than the other transitions because there was a much more elaborate stage setup that had to be put together. So basically, we were all standing there watching the thing be assembled. It was very impressive. Another thing that's important to note, and I want to briefly mention Miles Johnson's piece about black respectability politics that ran in the opinion section here about bringing this particular performance, which we'll get into the details of, but to a Coachella crowd. So Coachella does not sell individual day passes. You have to buy a weekend pass. But obviously, I think if you can get a VIP pass for one day, you can just go. The crowd on Saturday was very different than the crowd on Friday. Hmm. I've been to Coachella 4 times, I think. Mm-hmm. The Friday crowd was, as far as I can tell, a pretty straightforward Coachella crowd. Heavily white. Just a lot of kids wanting to hear songs about sex and drugs. I was standing for Beyonce, I was standing kind of at the back rim of the front VIP section. So basically right in front of the wall that separated the VIP section from the regular section, which is also where I was standing on Friday. On Friday, that crowd just on the other side of the wall was like pretty heavily white and kind of diverse. Mm-hmm. On Saturday, everyone there was black.
Wow.
That entire, like the first 5 to 10 kids spread over like 100 feet entirely. So the crowd was different. And just you could tell even walking around the field early in the day, the energy in the crowd was very, very different on Saturday. So I feel like sometimes, I mean, I detest Coachella. It's just like as a framework, I detest it as a social space. I detest it as kind of like a psycho-political space. Mm-hmm. But like it functioned differently on Saturday than it had on Friday. And I think that it's important to mention. Mm-hmm. So I've been up close at several Beyonce shows. Mm-hmm. Coachella very rarely allows the performer to come out into the crowd. That's not a thing that happens very much, but here it did. Mm-hmm. People were extremely sandwiched together. And the thing about being that close, and this is sort of, I don't want to say a strategic misstep on my part, but it's something that I thought about later. If I had stood back in the field, you could take in the full spectacle. Mm-hmm. I opted to be close because I wanted to see as many of the micro details as possible. Who could have anticipated how many micro details there were going to be? Mm. That's just something that no other Coachella performance that I've ever seen came close to. Damn near no other performance I've ever seen in any venue of any kind in any genre.
Yeah.
So being there was dizzying mm-hmm. because you literally have three dozen things to watch at any given time. And it was overwhelming is not the right word, but it was definitely you had to be alert for the entire performance. And I've been to other Beyonce shows where a lot is happening, but there'll be like a 2 minute stretch where you're like, gather yourself, come back. That never happened. Mm-hmm. Never happened for the whole 90 or 100 minutes. Mm-hmm. And just one additional detail as far as the experience of being there. So Coachella, outside of the sort of majesty of a Beyonce performance, is like a rather dismal setup. It takes a long time to get in and out of Coachella from a travel perspective. That night, Beyonce ended around 1 a.m. I did, as I sort of joked about early in the show, I did lose my car in the various parking lots. It took a very long time to find it. It was very dusty. It was very late. I did not get back to my hotel until after 3 a.m. And then I stayed up writing until 8 a.m. So for the people who are stressed about the two factual errors, trust me when I say no one was more mortified than I am. You couldn't possibly be more mortified than I am. But sometimes things like that happen in the post-Coachella trauma haze. Unfortunately, we don't really have any access to use the audio from the Coachella performance. Maybe at some point it will be formally released. So all the Beyonce songs you are hearing are studio recordings. Shrug, I wish it was different. This is Formation.
Y'all haters corny with that Illuminati mess. Paparazzi, catch my fly and my cocky fresh. I'm so reckless when I rock my Givenchy dress. I'm so possessive, so I rock his rock necklaces. My daddy Alabama, mama Louisiana. You mix that Negro with that Creole, make a Texas Bama. I like my baby hair with baby hair and afro. I like my Negro nose with Jackson 5 nostril. I earned all this money, but they never take the country out me. I got hot sauce in my bag, swag. I see it, I want it.
Did you guys watch it all straight, one take, like the whole thing?
So initially I thought that, so I had kind of a jiggered device that would create a scenario for me where I would be able to rewatch the performance later. Because I just thought, I was like, oh, I don't know if I'm actually going to be able to stay up for this. I've seen Beyonce, I think, three times at this point. I know the level of energy that she brings, but I also knew I was just like, this is going to be 2 hours long. Like, there's going to be some kind of elaborately produced break or something. Like, she can't possibly perform for that long. But then I ended up getting caught in her fugue, where it was just she's actually going to do that. And I found that I couldn't turn off the stream because I was so compelled by the new way that she had organized her musical career, basically. Mm-hmm. Because, like, she creates a narrative within the set list that kind of recontextualizes a lot of things. I think Beyonce, as much as, like, she has become sort of, like, a shorthand for, like, this is what, like, feminist culture wants to be. Like, this is the ideal. There was a long time where Beyonce actually wasn't a part of that conversation.
So true.
I would say, like, pre-Single Ladies, like, people thought of Beyonce as, like, an R&B star. Mm-hmm. And then that really kind of, like, opened up her, I would say, like, radius of influence. And I think there were just movements that she was making that I knew I needed to see live. It was like, okay, you're bringing out Kitty Cat. Like, you're doing Check On It. Like, you're doing certain things that are, like, proving people who naysayed you, like, 10 years ago when they were like, oh, like, Beyonce's making music for white women and that sort of thing. You're saying the thread never fell off.
And also, so part of the way that Beyonce was able to, I think, change the conversation about herself was she withdrew. Mm-hmm. She's not a person who releases 4 to 6 singles a year. She concentrates energy on large-scale projects in the last 4 or 5 years and basically lets you breathe in between then. And part of that strategy is you can take that out of your narrative. What you do in 2013 doesn't necessarily have to be an explicit continuation of what you did in 2009. And I think she's used silence and withdrawal really effectively. And so when you start to hear these songs remade, you're almost hearing them in my mind, out of the original context. Mm-hmm. You know the song because you know the lyrics, but I found at no point was I like, oh, I'd rather hear the original version of such and such song, because she started with a new musical idea and then took her songs as the sort of like raw material to build that idea on.
So I'm teaching this class, like you said earlier, called Family Feuds, and it's looking at Lemonade, Seat at the Table, and 444, and that in the order of the release of the albums, and then in that order that I just said. And what is interesting, now I have my students doing syllabi that they've constructed, and how would they teach a particular album or a song or a theme. And so what was interesting is using like Lemonade as the prism to understand Beyonce, they went back and then kind of recovered like B-Day as this like deeply political album, which there were these obviously elements there, but having Lemonade as the kind of almost like it's a palimpsest in some ways, like it's building on all of these other works of hers, and yet it's like its own thing, allows us to then go back in time and see seeds of these ideas, both like geographically, musically, politically. And so B-Day, through their lens, was like a deeply, profoundly political album. And my colleague Daphne Brooks talks about B-Day in the context of like Hurricane Katrina. But having Lemonade as our prism allows us to even see her earlier works that she's, like you're saying, actively reorganizing and then rearranging to have all these meanings, like whether it's feminism, whether it's Black Lives Matter.
Continuity of Southern musical tradition.
And New Orleans.
She is sometimes excluded from. Yeah. Or at least earlier in her career was like sometimes excluded from.
But then you're like, but yes, check on it. So like Southern, you know what I mean? Like there's all these ways
Soldier.
In which.
Soldier, yeah, of course.
T.I. and
so the Houston and New Orleans.
Let's listen to Soldier.
I want to see it. Got it, I'm the hottest around there. Know when they see you rolling them Impalas around it. With the top down, feeling the sounds quaking and vibrating your thighs. Riding harder than guys with the chrome wheels at the bottom, white leather inside. When them lanes be spitting at you, tell them don't even try to shoot it with Shell and kick it with Kelly or holler at B. You gotta be G's, you way out of your league. We like them boys up top from the BK. Know how to put that money three ways. Always riding big on the freeway. With that East Coast slang that us country girls we like. Low cut teasers with the deep waves. So quick to snatch up your Beyonce. Always coming down, popping our way. Telling us that country girls are kind of girls they like. Watching Coachella 2, right, like the second one that came out this weekend, like just the massiveness of the marching. I mean, like that seems so,
let's describe what happened, because maybe not everybody who's listening to that actually saw what happened. Yeah. So Beyonce's stage arrangement were basically like bleachers, like a stadium bleacher kind of situation. And I would say about 100 onstage performers, and that included straight up dancers, that included people who were dancing and playing instruments, it included backup singers, it included a string section, the complexity of the movement, the interweaving of the movement between all of those groups.
Like a marching band.
Yeah, right. It was ecstatic. It was profound, obviously referencing HBCU marching band culture, college football halftime game, et cetera. There are step shows, but these are all things that she brought in. Yeah. And I think her taking from those traditions was just so politically robust and also creatively fertile. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are to identify herself as an inheritor of those traditions instead of or in partnership with the inheritor of pop and R&B traditions. That's something that a lot of artists don't have the sort of bandwidth to do.
Yeah.
But she made it look easy.
Yeah. But I think she thinks of them as simultaneous traditions, right? Like, because when, like, if you're watching like the Bayou classic, if I called it like the Bayou classic after Coachella, Baychella, you know, they're performing like R&B songs or pop songs. So they're already in conversation with each other in real time. I think what Beyonce and her team were smart to do is just to kind of bring them together for us and then put them on the grand stage of Coachella. But then also I think we're in an interesting moment, and we could just talk about this, like where these artists, whether it's Beyonce or we're talking earlier about like a show like Atlanta, where there is this like deep kind of meditation on Black culture and Black cultural traditions without translation, mm-hmm. without interpretation, and not really caring whether people misunderstand what's happening. And I think that's always part of R&B, that may be part of gospel music. Unapologetically Black, I think, is like a quite fruitful phrase, but it's often overused these days. But I do think having this performance tapping into so many different African-American or African diasporic cultural traditions without saying anything, right? Like just performing it mm-hmm. and giving it to us, and we have to ingest it or take it in or refuse it, whatever we do with it, I thought was pretty marvelous. But it's also just a testament to a cultural moment that's happening that's not just Beyonce, I think, is part of that. She's probably on the high end and also mastering it. But I think it's happening in other art forms and other cultural experiences as well. It's a generational shift that I think is really important, and she's leading the way.
Salamisha, to your point, let's listen to a little bit of Baby Boy, which was one of my favorite moments in the performance. Unfortunately, the version of the performance sounds nothing like the original, but you'll just have to imagine how great it was. Here's the original Baby Boy.
I know you dig the way me step, the way me make me stride. Follow your feeling, baby girl, because it cannot be denied. Come take me in at the night, I make her get it amplified. But I quit for run the ship, and I go slip, and I go slide. In other words, the love I got to give it certified. For giving the toughest, longest time for ride, girl.
We can't overemphasize the significance of this performance being debuted at Coachella.
I wanted to talk.
It's everything.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that specifically because, okay, so before getting on a plane to go to California, I had actually had some disagreement with my editor about what are we even doing here? Like, we wrote a big thing a couple of years ago, like we're just not covering festivals anymore. Festivals are not sort of like a sociologically or intellectually fruitful site for music criticism. Like there's really not much that hasn't been done. Mm-hmm. What are the odds that we're going to go to a festival and like learn something? Mm-hmm. But obviously Beyonce is only U.S. tour date of the year. That's reason for to send me into the desert. Mm-hmm. I got a water bottle. I got, you know, it was like I had a hat, you know, it was like I didn't have a fanny pack because I don't believe in clout packs, even though they're popping.
You had
I don't
a
believe
backpack
in
though, probably.
I didn't actually didn't have a backpack. Oh. No, I did go to Dick's Sporting Goods to buy a carabiner to hang a water bottle off my belt loop. That's like a real thing. Check the expense report. but there was some conversation about why are we even doing this? Mm-hmm. And also this year at Coachella, the three headliners. Coachella is traditionally a rock festival or rock reunion festival, but also like a heavy dance and club aspect. Mm-hmm. But the headliners this year were The Weeknd, Beyonce, and Eminem. Mm-hmm. So obviously there's like a little bit of a title, no pun intended, shift in terms of like what festival culture is.
Yeah.
But even still, I was like, really? Like, do we really?
Yeah.
And then to see what she did this thing that sort of somehow acknowledged what Coachella occupies in the minds of many while also completely dismantling and obliterating it and like underscoring its fundamental uselessness.
Absolutely.
And that was mind-bending. Mm-hmm. And for the people who I think were normal Coachella goers watching that, I don't know if they got it, but if they did, like their heads should have been left on the Empire Polo Ground field because it was outstanding.
I don't usually
think of Beyonce in terms of her relationship to institutions. Mm-hmm. I've always thought that Beyonce is kind of like operating a little bit outside of trend, a little bit outside of, you know, what artists, you know, she's created her own company. Like she's almost like Tyler Perry in that way, where it's like, instead of having to interact with the system, I will create my own system.
Sure.
And it will be, you know, in many ways able to be independent of like various other arteries that other artists have to work through. And
if,
I think
if you work at Parkwood, DMs are open. Love to hear from you.
Yeah. We'd love to come visit Parkwood too. But I think what really coalesced for me was it's like there's been this accretive movement of Beyonce where she like invokes an institution and kind of like throws it away. And, you know, and like we can start with football at the Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. You know, that's something that I lodged that performance in my head and I'd said, oh, okay, this was like associated with Lemonade, associated with the Formation video, which came out the day before she did that performance. Obviously, Beyonce is very aware of what it means to perform in that space, right? Mm-hmm. And then I think the fact that she's kind of obliterating this one institution that we associate with excess, whiteness, no like real aesthetic convictions, Coachella, and then replacing it with the HBCU, which in and of itself is not obviously it was born of a radical prompt, which is to say that Black people will be educated by Black people. But at this point, it's like it's actually an ensconced institution in Black culture, right? So it was to me what was so fascinating was that it wasn't like Beyonce was like, I'm going to like purely appropriate this space. I'm going to replace it with like a storied institution. And it's going to act like a monument or like a mountain just like dug into the ground. It's so hilarious because, I mean, when we think about HBCUs like represented in culture, we think about like Drumline, you know, or like we don't really think of like high art efforts in that space. And she kind of.
Whoa. Nick Cannon's going to be sending us all kind of emails now.
I need to talk to Nick Cannon anyway. Like so,
yo.
But great, the Quad great is film. On BET as well.
Yeah.
True.
You know.
We should also underscore what Beyonce said. She didn't do a lot of speaking during this performance, but we should underscore one of the things she did say, which is she rightly acknowledged that she was the first Black woman to headline Coachella.
Yeah.
And then she said,
ain't that bad a bitch.
Ain't that bad a bitch.
I know. I love that. I wanted that on a t-shirt.
Single.
Why is it not on a t-shirt? How is that not available on the Beyonce website?
Well, it makes me wonder if it was actually extemporaneous. We don't associate Beyonce with extemporaneous speech anymore. You know, when like she like was at the Grammys and she won her award, she was reading off of a card. Beyonce's not going to get caught out there. But I wonder if that was really just like a moment of her kind of taking everything in.
Just
and
like it
like,
rupturing out.
Yeah. But with her, you can never tell.
The idea, like you said, the Super Bowl performance that she does, you know, where she really is the headliner, even though Coldplay is there to accompany her. And
never,
Bruno
I don't
Mars
even know that band.
To,
yeah. I've never even heard of that band.
But I mean, so I guess what I think is so fascinating is that even if we already know that Beyonce is going to surpass whatever expectation we have of that space and her performance in that space, there's still room for her to exceed what we already, I mean, that's, I guess that's the marvel of the moment is watching an artist both be at her artistic peak and her political peak. And we don't really get access to artists. Another one, you know, arguably will be like Kendrick Lamar, as we'll talk about later. But we don't get to see that because even, let's say, 444, building on Jay-Z's long career and his engagement in politics. But here, I think we see him in his most fully formed political activist voice outside of the album and then a kind of deep introspective voice on the album. But no one would say this is his like artistic peak per se, right? But with Beyonce, we're seeing such a phenomenon I don't really know how to categorize quite. We saw it with artists maybe in the 60s and some artists in the 70s. But for us who grew up in this era, like hip hop and now pop, it's rare like to be so political and so good at the same moment. I mean, this is like Marvin Gaye, Stevie Wonder in the 70s, you know, like this is what we're dealing with. And yet she's doing something else because she's so aware of her place as a Black woman in an industry and in a country that really doesn't allot too much space for gender and race to operate the same way for us to see her, right? Like she's surpassing and breaking conventions in so many different ways at once. So
one of the, depending how you look at it, either perks or traumas of consuming culture in the contemporary moment is the simultaneous conversation. Did you guys sense at all, because it was tough for me to sense it because I was there physically and I wasn't really on Twitter that night, or at least not until I got back to the hotel. Did you guys sense a bifurcation in the reception between those who 100% understood what was happening and those who were like,
oh, that's a good question.
That was cool.
Absolutely. I think that what was made very plain that night was that Beyonce has been performing for a very long time. You know, she started Destiny's Child debuted, I think, when Beyonce was 15 years old. Now she's 36. Mm-hmm. And I think that there was...
Don't say Beyonce's age.
Sorry. Sorry, Beyonce. Sorry, sir, Rumi and Blue.
True.
Didn't mean to do that. Yeah. But, I mean, it's important to note because I think that in general, it's hard to have careers that have that longevity at any point. But then to be able to make as many leaps and bounds that she's made from girl group to soloist to rapper. You know, Beyonce has covered a lot of territory. Mm-hmm. And I think that there was actually, it was so surprising to me because she's someone who I kind of take for granted as everyone just like knowing what she's made. You know, everyone having like a fluency with respect to her production. I think a lot of people were caught off guard by some of the earlier cuts. And not only that, but they were caught off guard by the musicology, which you talked about so wonderfully in your piece, that element, which is to say that Beyonce is someone who actively listens to other music and actually finds out how she might like interpolate that music within her own. And I think that was what really separated the wheat from the chaff in the watching of it. That to me was like the educational element, where it was like, if you have been invested and if you have done your due diligence as a listener, you're going to leave this performance with like a whole other appreciation for what it is that she works on. And if you're a casual listener, you're also going to have a great time. But it's like she's speaking in codes.
Yeah.
And you're not going to pick up on
I almost can't think of another performer in any genre who so routinely rethinks his, her, or their own music. Mm-hmm. And I find that really striking because I almost feel like sometimes I watch concerts of people who don't listen to their own music. They just sort of like, they like roll it out when they need to make the $50,000 show date happen. But like in between those dates, they're not paying attention. And Beyonce seems like someone who's constantly reinterrogating and almost saying this is a preferred version. Like, this is actually how I would like you to hear those Destiny Child songs. This is actually how I would like you to hear these songs from Four.
When I teach Beyonce, like, I often talk about her being highly citational and deeply, she's like a historian of like American music. And so she's always pulling from different parts of whether it's like through her physical performance, like through dance or through the video production and the setting or through musical gestures or vocal gestures that she's making, that she's always paying attention to performers that have come before her and integrating that, like you said, interpolating them into her work. So she's so like backward looking and forward thinking that I think that's why her relationship to time is also so interesting. Like, when the Super Bowl performance, where she was the headliner and like literally the lights went out at the stadium in New Orleans, like I was like, oh, she stops time. And what does that mean when someone stops time? Like, she stops time by dropping an album without us knowing. She stops time by like literally captivating an entire weekend or week of audiences and fans paying attention to her. And then she has this relationship to innovation and historicity.
Here's a bit of Single Ladies.
Oh,
One thing I wanted to touch on briefly was, or were, the differences between kind of experiencing that show live in that setup, in that crowd, and then being able to watch it back in a potentially, you know, semi-illicit fashion after the fact. So I was very struck live by Beyoncé's choices about when to include herself in the larger narrative of what everybody on stage was doing and almost allow it to swaddle her, and at what parts she stepped outside of it and sort of took control of the narrative. But one of the things about being there is your view of it is not dictated by the cameras. Mm-hmm. You're just sort of you're looking in a bunch of different places. And a lot of times, even when Beyoncé was separate, I found myself not looking at her directly. I found myself looking at what was happening on stage, which was still a complete, you know, like action film of activity. Like it was, there was nothing, no one was taking a break. No one was sitting down for 60 seconds while Beyoncé was out on the platform hovering over the crowd. And it was interesting watching afterwards with the more dictated visual choices about, I know this is going to sound ridiculous, but like it looked like a Beyoncé show on the stream. Mm-hmm. And live, it was like someone had dropped me just in the middle of a football game as it was happening. Mm. And you just got dropped on the 50-yard line because no matter where you looked, something wild and crazy and outstanding was happening. Mm. So it was, I was sort of almost bummed to have my visual choices dictated by the stream. Mm-hmm. That was, I especially having felt that kind of totality.
Mm-hmm. That's really fascinating to me because the screen, especially the YouTube stream, it was very small. Mm-hmm. And it took me a while to actually understand the width of what was happening. The bleachers, they also double as a pyramid, and she kind of like stands as a capstone. Mm-hmm. That's when I realized there's a lot of people here. It was an interesting change for Beyoncé because I was, in anticipating this performance, I was wondering, well, how do you move forward from Lemonade, right? It was such a wholly designed world. You know, it begins with her as a shoon, mm-hmm. falling into the ocean, and then she's like on these ghostly plantations and stuff. And those spaces were like very like natural and very much like based in the Daughters of the Dust kind of American geography. Mm-hmm. You know, I wasn't so much concerned with like the narratives of infidelity and that sort of thing, but I was like, aesthetically, how do you move forward from something that was so fully realized and had such a like very particular point of reference? Going the route of maximalism, like in retrospect, it makes like all the sense in the world because it's like Beyoncé through Lemonade inherits all, like she finally coalesces all of the inheritances that she has in music, right? And then she's like, I'm actually going to just like put them on display via this like HBCU filter, I guess you could describe it as. And I think it's like very, it's going to be important for us to think of Beyoncé as like kind of like a band leader sort mm-hmm. of figure moving on. And it reminds me of what Prince said to her when she was young, and he was like, you learn piano, like it changes everything. And Prince was the sort of artist who was like, he actually could play every single instrument in a performance or on his album, but so much of being an artist and a musician was about like literally feeding people, like making sure that people had jobs. And I think like that to me seems so inseparable to the way that we have to think about Beyoncé in terms of making her music now. It's that she really wants us to confront the fact that music is accretive and that it involves taking all these separate wills, all these separate intuitions, and making them move in concert and making them move in synchronicity. Honestly, some of my favorite parts in the performance were when she kind of, you know, she was changing or whatever, mm-hmm. but also sometimes she wasn't, and just like let Didi Emma, who was that amazing, she was like playing the majorette and she did that baton. I was like, I was like, girl, what are you going to do next? Like, are you going to swallow that baton? Like, she was incredible. Beyoncé is very shrewd when it comes to recognizing that she can only enhance her performance by giving us these little like tidbits, these little
and also
refreshers.
Accessing kind of all this other adjacent greatness. Mm-hmm. I had a conversation in recent weeks with someone I know who is a producer and songwriter who has worked with Beyoncé, not a lot, but a little bit. And this person said that she's at the point where she's listened to the producer, but she's producing the producers.
Yeah.
Like it's all in her head. And so she's bringing in, like some producers bring in session musicians and they bring in, you know, like I need a guitar for this and I need a a certain kind of drum part for this, but she's doing that with producers. And he's like, it's just very inspiring to watch how she is so open to incorporating all these folks. And these are folks who normally have the huge ego in the room.
Yeah.
And they just come in and like are in service of that vision.
This idea that collaboration is itself and harnessing collaboration as a form of genius, I think is something that we should finally give Beyonce credit for. She's not the only person. People have been practicing collaborative projects for a very long time. But I do think historically that's been something that people have used against her when it comes to like Grammy Awards or something like that, or the category of genius. And I think what she does, and what's important about collaboration too, is that it's in a way of imagining a kind of political collective. So it's not only an artistic practice, but here we have this Black world that she's putting on both the insignia with like the Black Panther, Queen Nefertiti, I guess Queen Beyonce, the B, and the Black Power Fist, right? Those are the four things. And then there's this like Black collective that she's performing on stage before us. And then it's also like a moment in what does it mean to like celebrate Black people and Black lives in the era of Trump. I mean, there's all this stuff that's going on through collaboration and collectivity that I think she's enabling us to see and then hold. And I think that's really powerful too. So
I think especially between Lemonade and 444, you have this tabloidist narrative that begins to overtake the public conversation about both Beyonce and Jay-Z. And it was so kind of like refreshing and kind of a relief to experience those songs, or at least some of the songs, the Lemonade songs, completely free of a tabloidist narrative.
Absolutely.
And not have to worry about that.
Yeah.
And even like when Jay does come out late in the set, and I'm forgetting who tweeted this, so whoever this is that tweeted it, if you're listening, like just at me or email me, let me know. Someone said that when he came out, he looked like her 19-year-old son.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know what that means.
Wild,
he looks young? Like he just looked overpowered by her.
Like just like
she was guiding him on stage, basically.
Okay, that makes sense.
And that was real. That was real in person, too. Just FYI. Like that's accurate.
Yeah, but I'm sure he's in awe of her.
I mean, he should be.
He better be.
Yeah.
Let's not even get on the topic of
Right. No, let's also resist tabloidism.
So one artist to another is what I was thinking of. So,
But
and also Jay.
The Lemonade narrative was interesting because it was the first album that really put her in time. Whereas Beyonce, obviously, people are like, oh, like Beyonce is like a grown woman now. But that was something that was sort of like vaguely every woman artist has their like, I'm coming out as a fully fledged woman with powerful sexuality. Every woman artist
has. Like her self-titled album.
Yes. Yeah, Beyonce in 2013. Mm-hmm. That was that message. Mm-hmm. Whereas Lemonade was like, you were like, oh, I can look at the calendar and I can associate this song with around this time.
It was like Keeping Up with the Kardashians.
It was, and it like really confused me, honestly, when I first listened to the album, because I had been trained in the way that I consume Beyonce to not overly read personal narrative into the music that she makes. And then it was like she was like forcing me to do that. But then one thing that I noticed in the performance was like I wasn't really thinking about the Lemonade songs in terms of like, oh, this was like a personal revelation. I was thinking of songs more like Me, Myself, and I. You know, which is like that's not when we're thinking about Beyonce and tabloidism. Mm-hmm. We're not thinking about Beyonce as divulging anything in that moment. Mm. That's the time when people were saying that Beyonce wasn't a musician, that she was just like had been Svengali'd by her father since she was 3 years old into being an automaton of perfection. And then, again, I feel like I keep harping on this, but it's true that it's like her albums operate in a circle, and you can start at any given point and then follow them and then at like leave with like a different conclusion than if you started with a different album. And I just kept thinking as she was performing those like older cuts, you know, like 10-year-old songs, where I was like, I actually had no idea what Beyonce was going through personally, spiritually.
Yeah.
I just thought that these were standard R&B songs. I wasn't trained to listen to her in the way that I listened to Mary J. Blige.
Yeah.
But now I've been like completely, that she has like cultivated that
alarm
in me.
Has a different meaning now.
It does. Even songs like Bow Down have like a more intensified meaning.
So that's interesting. So in a way, these sort of reframings of the songs in the live context at Coachella helped denature some of the later what we have thought of as tabloidist moments, but also the kind of the big picture stitching together across her career have actually reinvested some of that older material mm-hmm. with additional meaning that it maybe resisted or was discouraged from taking on at the time.
Yeah, or even single ladies. I mean, you think about that's just, you know, you at the time it's a hit and it's.
It's Justin Timberlake, SNL, yeah. And like all this stuff.
And it's caught up with all these. And to bring back the other point.
Dead ass.
Caught up with all these respectability politics, but then you don't read it fully as like autobiographical. We read it as like part of her, I don't know if it's quite feminist, but it's a near feminist message. But now you're like, oh, that song may, what do we do with that if we look at it through an autobiographical lens? It does change the nature of that song. So I just think going backwards and looking at her music through Lemonade, it opens up a lot of possibilities too. But she's aware of, that's why you're saying she has these dynamic rearrangements of the song.
Here's Don't Hurt Yourself. So not to have too harsh a, but when's Beyonce going to win a Pulitzer? Because I want to be honest, like the last paragraph of my piece where I talk about the Adele thing being kind of a glitch that no one's going to think about. Because I honestly,
but don't you
I mean, it was an entire history. It was literally living history. Yeah. It was living musicology. It was living history. And I just saw in my mind, like in 2034, mm-hmm. like her accepting the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Like I just, it just seems so, it's such a given.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, that's a big idea for this week. And then 24 hours later, or 36 hours later, Kendrick Lamar actually comes and wins a Pulitzer.
And I guess that the combination of those two things speaks to the way in which like the Grammys are increasingly irrelevant.
Oh, yeah.
But I think for musicians, right, like I'm not a musician, so there are in all of our fields, there are these places or testaments to our mastery of whatever it is, right? And the Pulitzer would be probably a big one. So I think for musicians.
I wouldn't know.
Yeah. I think for musicians, it's still.
You two will get your Pulitzers the same year.
I think that.
You're a podcasting Pulitzer? What's up?
Yeah, very good.
There will be soon.
Yeah, there probably will. See, this is why we have to stay with the podcast in the future. But I guess like, the combination of Kendrick getting it and Beyonce's Beychella performance shows just how irrelevant on one hand and misguided the Grammys. Like, because I think this year's Grammys was like the corrective, like it was the potential for, obviously. Right. And I still thought it was weird,
right,
too.
Like except if, you only get as far as Bruno.
Yeah.
Like you don't actually correct the whole
thing. And I also thought it would be weird if like Jay-Z as a corrective to Beyonce. I mean, because there's something about black women performers that is the kind of doubly or triply invisibilized. And that's why Beyonce matters so much, because we have to see her regardless of whatever gaze we're using. We just have to confront her awesome power, and that's doing a lot of political and historic work. Okay, fine. But yeah, I think Kendrick also not getting Album of the Year and then getting this, it's like, man.
I have to admit, I pshawed when I saw. Is that?
Go
I
in.
I feel like I'm speaking like a comic book right now, but when I saw that he
I see the bubble. I see the speaking bubble. Like it has like the jagged
you're very,
edge.
You're
it's
very
like the
fancy jagged words edge that bubble. You're using. Yeah, so it's fine.
But I was completely just knocked off my chair. And my first reaction was not, wow, yes, Kendrick won the Pulitzer. I was like, what does Kendrick have to do with the Pulitzer? Mm. And
yeah,
I
this is you all.
I stand by this. I mean, I don't think he's actually said anything about it yet. People at TDE.
No. He hasn't. His manager.
You know, like I think in Joe's piece.
He hasn't.
He hasn't said anything. And obviously, you know, we have histories. I mean, like Nas was the first person that comes up when you're like, okay, like finally the Pulitzer's decided to recognize hip hop, which is a very loaded, I think, interaction of cultures. He was someone who kind of like sort of facetiously, but also like very honestly was like, where's my Pulitzer? Yeah. And that's the problem I think that I had with the way the award was presented. This idea that this award was doing as much for hip hop as it was doing for the history of the Pulitzers, I think is just like a little bit convoluted.
I believe the response is lol, nah.
It really isn't. And I think that Kendrick is a really complicated artist because he invokes that kind of like high art connection. You know, like he's going to perform with an orchestra. He's going to have an album that really is a jazz album that's masquerading as a hip hop album. And I think that was the number one thing that I didn't understand. It was like, I actually prefer to listen to Damn than I do to Pimp a Butterfly. But if you, you know, had put me in like the sixth circle of hell and you were like, Doreen, like to get out of here, you have to guess which album that Kendrick is going to win. I would have said Butterfly like in a second. Mm-hmm. And I think like what aggravated me, and aggravate is the right verb, is that I didn't like the framing of like this album was an instance of looking into like the interior psyche of the African-American community. That's actually not the narrative of Damn. Damn is like, it's removed from that work that he was doing actually on To Pimp a Butterfly. And it's very much about Kendrick sort of like occupying different people and different personas. And so I was like, this is both like a misreading of the album and also like a very cynical way of honoring hip hop.
But also a misreading of the album by people who my best guess is don't generally listen to hip hop. No disrespect to Farrah Jasmine Griffin, who I know is on the committee and I'm sure listens to a fair amount of hip hop. But I mean, you know, I saw the other people who are on the committee and no cap, but like my guess is they don't listen to a lot of rap music. And if you read the pieces about how this came to pass, what they said is they were considering classical works. I assume modern composition, classical works that took hip hop as a reference point or point of influence or something. And then they had this sort of aha moment like,
we could just give it.
I wonder what's going on in hip hop. Then someone said, play a Kendrick Lamar record, and then boom, sorry to the other classical people who are nominated.
No, I mean, I guess I thought like how often these conversations have been happening that we don't know up until this moment. Like, what's modern music? What's influencing classical music? What's influencing like high art music? Maybe that'd be the best way of saying it. But, and then you have all these, like, it sounded like composers who were deeply influenced by hip hop because that's the generation that's creating. Mm-hmm. And then for us, it's like hip hop is clearly supplanted rock. It's like the American musical form, blah, 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 blah. This is true. And it no longer has to prove itself to anyone, right? Like,
it's the grammar. Music. Yeah. It's just the grammar.
Yeah, it's exactly. And we have probably spent much of our career restating that fact and trying to come up with new and fancy ways of saying the same thing. But because we're always
true
like,
story.
Hey, yeah.
Like, do your Googles. Okay, let's listen to Humble from Kendrick Lamar's Damn.
Right stroke, put a baby in a spiral. Soprano C, we like to keep it on the high note. It's levels to it, you and I know. Tell them be humble. Sit down. Be humble. Sit down. Sit down, be humble. 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 Sit down.
Speaking speaking of what exactly is going on with the Pulitzer Prizes, I spoke also today with Zach Wolf, who is the Times' classical music editor and also a hell of a critic himself. What's up, Zach?
Hey.
First time on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so excited. So, as I said, Zach is our classical music editor and also a hell of a critic on his own terms. What's really good with the Pulitzer Prize? Like, talk to me. Because in the remainder of this podcast, I'm going to talk to Doreen and Salamisha about kind of the broader context of institutional acknowledgement of hip-hop and et cetera, et cetera. But let's talk about this from the classical music perspective. You also did a really robust back and forth with John Perellis, who's our chief pop music critic, talking about the issues at stake. But explain to us the significance of the Pulitzer Prize from your side of the world.
Well, even within sort of the classical, I put that in quotes, yes, sort of community, the Pulitzer has always sort of occupied this sort of weird space. It, for a long time, represented like an extremely specific part of classical music. It was as if like a Grammy for hip hop only went to Atlanta hip hop. I mean, it was the winners of the Pulitzer were for decades, by and large, with exceptions, kind of representatives of what was sort of known as sort of the academic school of American composition, which was what was called that because that was sort of what the kind of post Schoenberg atonal serialism that had increasingly drifted from what anyone in the world listened to into the universities. Mm-hmm. And so the home for that music was just university departments, and those were the only people who played and listened to it as that's, I mean, because that stuff was thorny and complex and often very proudly unfriendly.
And that, what time period are we talking about with that stuff?
So the Pulitzers, I mean, we have the first winner here, the first winners in 43. Mm-hmm. And so, through the 50s and 60s, 70s, and even into the 80s, it begins to modulate stylistically a little, like letting in a little bit more of like tonality, neo-romanticism as academic. I mean, as that grip, which was, I mean, immediately post-war period was like a stony grip.
So when do things start to change?
So things start to change, I mean, in the 80s there's all throughout this. I mean, for every Elliot Carter who is winning, there is like a Dominic Argento who won for this beautiful song cycle based on Virginia Woolf's diaries.
Okay.
There was like a little bit of wiggle room always, but still, by and large, it was going to like a very small and often was kind of perceived not solely as like a lifetime achievement award, but it was generally going to mature composers.
Okay.
It was going to people sort of well into their career. Unlike the Nobel, it's a particular piece that wins. You win for a work. A person doesn't win, or a certain body of work, by and large. But then, through the 80s and then the 90s, we begin to have a bunch of change, which sort of culminates in 97, Wynton Marsalis wins for this oratorio he writes about sort of the Middle Passage.
This is Blood on the Fields.
Yes, exactly. And so that is a real, I mean, even though that was for a really kind of classical form, I mean, this was an oratorio and Marsalis was a guy who was really is obviously a key figure in jazz.
But also institutionalization of jazz.
Totally. And certainly has been very welcomed into the symphonic world and has sort of composed symphonies, I mean, with and without his band.
And that win, if I remember correctly, at the time was sort of controversial coming from both sides.
Totally.
Controversial coming from the classical side about, we're doing this now. But also from the jazz side, basically being like, he doesn't represent what's actually happening in jazz.
Totally. I mean, yeah, I think he's always been sort of, or certainly for a while, has been controversial in jazz as for that kind of nostalgist, a sort of reactionary strand that he represents. Classical is sort of happy to have anyone who's going to bring in other audiences. I mean, coming from a genuine point of view, not just a kind of like give us money point of view, but like it's like there is this sort of stereotype of this sense of exclusivity that got thrown around even most this past week or two. It's, I think, less about exclusivity than just a sense of really wanting new audiences and to like make it as relevant as possible, even to a fault, I would say. And so Marsalis was a big deal. And then 10 years after that, in 2007, Ornette Coleman mm-hmm. wins for Sound Grammar, which is the first time I'm almost positive mm-hmm. that an album won. But that was a performance recording. And so the next step that we have here is with Kendrick, mm-hmm. where it's an album that does not represent a performance that happened or a kind of piece on manuscript that is designed for continued interpretations.
Which is a thing that people from my side don't think at all about, but is actually quite a controversial thing happening coming from the other perspective.
Yeah, right. So it's a thing. It's definitely a thing. I mean, it's one of the distinction, even with contemporary classical music, is the idea of it would be possible for other people to interpret this and like to kind of do this piece again. And when you're awarding not even Kendrick's songs, but the album,
right?
It is a produced, finished mm-hmm. object that will not be reinterpreted.
Although, and this is interesting because earlier in the podcast, one of the things we were talking about the Beyoncé Coachella performance is how she consistently reinterrogates her own work. Now, that's different than interpreting someone else interpreting the work, but that she uses her songs as source material for new broad-scale narratives about her career, about the history of black music in America, et cetera. And I actually, hearing you say that, makes me think, well, maybe the Kendrick album could be ripe for such a treatment. It just hasn't been done to date, but maybe it could be ripe for that treatment.
Yeah, I mean, I assume that Kendrick is going to kind of return to these songs mm-hmm. for years to come, I mean, for the rest of his career. And I mean, even in live performances, I mean, that's a staple of pop music. Yeah, you're kind of working through as the catalog builds, then these things can be like mixed and mashed in different ways. And I'm sure it's possible for people to cover certain songs that he did, and that would be totally acceptable. But it was sort of a huge sea change on a number of levels, both kind of in terms of genre and then this issue of what was being awarded as in terms of something that was really an entity that was sort of complete and playable instantly.
Obviously, there's been some mixed reaction inside the classical music world to this win. I'm curious, you brought up a lot of these points in your piece with JP in your back and forth dialogue, but I wonder if you can talk a little bit about, now that there's been a week to breathe, is there a prevailing sentiment one way or the other?
The reaction was, I think, really positive in a sense that this was a totally deserving winner of this prize. I think that there was just, as I said, I think the word that I used was like, yeah, a kind of wariness or a sense of like, okay, like an openness to certainly genre being like the Pulitzer being open to folk and jazz and hip hop. Right. But the idea that why this like a Grammy headliner number one album was going to get this award, which had been, through all of its stylistic ups and downs, been really more of an award for stuff that was flying a little more under the radar,
right,
regardless of the style. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that there would have been as much reluctance mm-hmm. had it been esoteric hip-hop artists.
Right. I mean, I often am continually shocked that Kendrick Lamar is as popular as Kendrick Lamar.
Oh, no, exactly.
And I say this, and like when I think of like the obvious forebears for Kendrick Lamar, and I think of the sort of like jazz influenced Los Angeles underground of like 1991 and 1992. And I think of that sort of that fertile space for experimenting with vocal styles. I mean, you know, the Caroline Shaw piece is like a vocal piece. And I think of what Kendrick is influenced by as essentially experimental vocal jazz routed through a hip hop framework.
Totally.
This happens to be probably his most accessible record, mm-hmm. but I know the tradition from which he comes. So if it's any consolation, Kendrick's kind of an esoteric guy who just sort of like is an accidental pop star.
Totally. Which is, I mean, which is, and is fantastic. And like, and I'm knowing somebody wrote to me on Twitter, or like tweeted at me that it was the 37th best selling album of the year or something. And there was, so it's like, it's not that popular. And I was like, well, let's compare that to Caroline Shaw. It's
sure.
Like, yes, even 37 is a change.
Shouts to that person.
I know. I was like,
whoever that person is, send me your data. I want all your data. Zach, thank you for coming and explaining the context. I was actually struck in reading about how this all came to pass. Someone from the board, the Pulitzer nominating committee, said that some of the classical music that they were listening to had some strains of hip hop in it. Is there something that you think we could listen to that would maybe give us a flavor of kind of how we ended up even going in this direction in the first place?
One of the finalists, okay. Ted Hearn's sounds from the bench is, this is obviously the hardest thing to do, is to kind of have a hip hop influence.
Sure.
X. And Ted does it really beautifully. I mean, in that it's coming from a certain rock tradition, but there is a word play. There is like the sense of like kind of fragmented text. And he's definitely somebody who's thinking about that kind of cross genre influence.
All right. So let's listen to a little Ted Hearn sound from the bench. And also everybody go home and study some Christian Marcotte. Okay, thanks to Zach, and now we are back with Doreen and Salamisha.
I think what's interesting is more about like not ignoring the source. And so part of what in our earlier conversation about Beyoncé is like, what does it mean to kind of hold up these sources of like Black cultural creativity as originary material, as originary source material, and validate it as such? And so you have in one moment an artist doing that quite profoundly, and then another moment you have Pulitzer Committee doing. And so it's just what I read it at. But of course it's overdue. And I think, you know, we could think about this in the context, obviously, of Dylan winning the Nobel. Like, is this possible without that other moment? And then of course, when he wins it, then people, you know, there's all sorts of chatter about what that means and da-da-da. I think there's less chatter with Kendrick winning the Pulitzer.
Well, yeah. Like I mean, Dylan won. Dylan is a musician who won ostensibly in a category that's not his category in
literature.
Yes, yeah. Right. But Kendrick won for music.
Yeah, so, which is closer to
yes.
we'll agree to that. Okay.
And Doreen, I totally agree as far as To Pimp a Butterfly goes, because it's Damn is Kendrick's pop record in so much as he is somehow capable of making a pop record, which he is. I would almost venture to say borderline not totally capable of making a pop record, but this is certainly, if you live in Los Angeles and listen to Los Angeles radio, like this is like basically like flow. It's like Flow Rida out there. Like it's just like every third song is a Kendrick song, which is not how you experience it if you listen to New York radio.
That's kind of cool in a way,
course.
Right? Because like, his political message is.
And
I mean, I'm not going to diss Flow Rida because I'm sure.
No, please disobey.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying. No, like, it's a safe space. But To Pimp a Butterfly is the superior musical accomplishment, the superior philosophical accomplishment. It is the work of Kendrick's that is most robustly in dialogue across genre, across eras. But it's also, in a way, the Pulitzer adopted the Grammy problem here, where it was like, oh, right, we forgot. That guy, we should do something with that person. And it just so happened that Damn was the album in the year that they finally awoke to the need to do the thing.
Yeah.
I don't know if those people listened to Pimp a Butterfly when it came out. You know, like, I don't know. But it's not like the Pulitzer has, like, a really rich history with jazz regardless.
Yeah.
It's mostly modern classical.
Yeah. So hopefully this opens up the category to hearing differently, I suppose. Is it
wickedness? Okay, this is Blood from Damn. Is it weakness? You decide. Are we gonna live or
die? So I was taking a walk the other day. And I seen a woman, a blind woman, pacing up and down the sidewalk. She seemed to be a bit frustrated, as if she had dropped something and having a hard time finding it. So after watching her struggle for a while, I decided to go over and lend a helping hand, you know.
The way it refracts on the actual space of hip-hop right now is really fascinating, because on the one hand, you have these people who are actually kind of a generation behind. They're where they should have been in, like, 91, mm-hmm. saying that this is an American art form. Mm-hmm. And actually, it can produce the best music out of all forms.
Yeah,
that's not really the argument we should be having in 2018, especially when you have a whole crop of musicians who are actually repudiating hip-hop in history while quote unquote making that music. And so that's really but you can't divorce that those two things are happening. It's like two forks in the road, you know, where it's like hip-hop is turning 50. Hip-hop is going to get its museums, its or mausoleums, however you want to put
true.
And then at the same time, you have these kids who are like 19 who are like, I hate Tupac, I never listened to Biggie, like, I don't like that. And those kids are Black. And so
and have $1 million record deals.
You know, I think we're almost like post-rapper in a way.
Oh, yeah.
Cardi is someone who you can think of that way. Like, Cardi is a good rapper who's getting better, but is also 10 other things. And that has always been her practice. It hasn't been, she's not the sort of artist who's like, you know, she's not Lamarian in any way. She's not saying that she writes all of her lyrics. She's just not like interested in that ecosystem, I would say, of like genius or that sort of thing. And so to me, it's just like, it's sort of absurd that the Pulitzers are venerating hip hop in this way, whereas like the actual institution itself is like a little bit like imploding.
Let's talk about storytelling and history. Let's listen to Duckworth.
Just remember, what happens on earth stays on earth. We're gonna put it in reverse.
Darling, I told you many times, and now I'm telling you once again, just to remind you, sweetheart, that my...
Oh, Lamar, Hail Mary, your Mary, times is hard. Pray with the hooligan, shadows all in the dark. Fellowship with demons and relatives, I'm a star. Life is one funny mob, a true comedian, you gotta love him, you gotta trust him. I might be bugging, infomercials and no sleep. Introverted by my thoughts, children listen, it gets deep. See, once upon a time inside the Nickerson Garden Projects, the object was to process and digest poverty's dialect. Adaptation inevitable, gun violence, spot federal policies, rape builders and drug professionals. Anthony was the oldest of seven, well-respected, calm and collected. Laughing and joking made life easier. Hard times, mama, a 40-year-old telling his nanny he needed her. His family history, pimping and banking. He was meant to be dangerous. Done. Clacked him a grip and starts 15, scraping up his jeans with quarter pieces. Even got some from a smoker last weekend. Dodger policeman working for his big homie. Small town hustler graduated to
a... Okay, so this is something I struggle with and think about a lot. Doesn't that mean that we won, kind of? That like all the things that we were fighting for in the 80s or 90s that we were trying to convince people of are now taken for granted to such a degree that you could have an entire generation of rappers who take it for granted and ignore it and overlook it and almost denigrate it. And to say nothing of people from the outside finally being like, okay, y'all were right all along. The fact that those things are happening at the same time are not unrelated.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, obviously I have like a entrenched skepticism of people who are like, I don't listen to Biggie Smalls. Like, obviously that's going to like set me a little bit. But also, we're old.
I'm old.
Doreen is forever
like
young.
You're like millennial. Are you millennial?
I am a millennial.
Yeah, I'm not a millennial.
Doreen's extremely young.
I know you were. Just kidding.
I'm old and from Brooklyn. You know, like I'm going to feel that way. You know, like, if I was 17 right now, like it's not like there's not a course. Like you literally teach a course. When I was in college, true story, the first course that mentioned hip hop. When I was in college, I took – it was 1995, and it was literally my final project for that class was to write the syllabus for the class because they didn't have a syllabus because people were just like, we don't even know what we're doing here.
Yeah.
I literally wrote a syllabus in that class.
No. I mean, I took Farrah Jasmine Griffin taught at Penn, and I did take a class on jazz and literature, which kind of gave me the possibility that you could teach. Literally, you can teach classes. Yeah. She was writing a book on Billie Holiday at the time. But yeah, no, I agree with you. I mean, I think one, yes, this is the question of the hour, though. It's like, what does it mean? Even including Bruno in this conversation, I actually think, like, what does it mean? And Daphne, to invoke her again, Brooks, I saw a talk of hers and she said, you know, what does it mean to win the cultural battles, but like we're losing the political war? Like, because there's like, this is why, you know, we talk of like a civil war, like a cultural civil war happening. It's like, this matters. And yet, what the artists are in some ways protesting shows a kind of durability of American racism, like Kendrick and Beyonce being part of Black Lives Matter shows that we haven't really won everything, that we've won a moment to have new spokespeople championing old issues. And then we also have this backdrop of like a really hostile climate of the Trump administration. So it's like a weird moment. Like, yeah, like Kendrick winning or Beychella. But progress has been made.
Should we go out with DNA?
Yeah.
All right, Kendrick's DNA.
I got loyalty, got royalty inside my DNA. Quarter piece, got war and peace inside my DNA. I got power, poison, pain, and joy inside my DNA. I got hustle, though, ambition, flow inside my DNA. I was born like this, it's born like this, immaculate conception. I transform like this, perform like this, which yells you a new weapon. I don't contemplate, I meditate, then off your head. This that put the kids to bed, this that I got.
That's our show this week. Thank you for listening. Thank you to my guests, Salome Shatila and Dory Sanfelix. Also, shout outs to Daphne Brooks,
yeah,
who I haven't talked to in a really
Trisha
long time.
Rose, too.
Oh, shouts to Trisha Rose and also Andre Craddock Willis. Shouts to Sam Hine at Corporate Lunch and Micah Jensen Lewis. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. You can email us at podcast@nytimes.com. You can subscribe to the podcast, the future Pulitzer winning podcast at Stitcher, Google Play Audio. It's going to seem prophetic. Anywhere you get your audio content, smash that MF and subscribe button. Our producer, fresh off a train delay, is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back next week. Probably offend you. This is Parler's oldest son. I know murder, conviction, burners, boosters, burglars, ballers, dead, redemption, scholars, fathers, dead, with kids, and I wish I was fed. Forgiveness, yeah.